Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. First case this morning is Exelon versus Local 15 and Ms. Bohr.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Victoria Bohr. I'm counsel for Local 15 of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. The issue in this case is whether Nuclear Regulatory Commission regulations bar arbitration of a licensee's decision to deny or revoke employees' authorization for unescorted access to a nuclear plant. To work in certain areas of a nuclear facility, employees need unescorted access authorization. Local 15 and Exelon, an NRC licensee, are parties to a collective bargaining agreement that has an arbitration provision.
Is this a financial basis? That is, if you paid more having access to these areas?
Well, Your Honor, in order to actually get into the plant and do the work, you need to have access to the plant.
So this is whether you can keep the job.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. So if you don't have access, you can't work. And if you have a job and your access is
revoked. Financial in that sense, that's what I meant.
Well, that's right. But it's this is the people's livelihood is at stake. I think that's a point. As I was saying, that the collective bargaining agreement in this case has an arbitration clause that covers access denial decisions. Exelon maintains, and the lower court found, that NRC regulations that were promulgated in 2009 prohibit such arbitration, but neither the language of the regulations nor their regulatory history supports that conclusion. There are two provisions in the regulation that are at issue here. Only one of them directly deals with review of access denials, and that is Section 76.53L. It requires licensees to provide employees whose access has been revoked or denied with an appeal procedure, and states that, among other things, the procedure must provide for an internal independent review.
Ms. Bohr, before you get into the details of that, can I just ask a background question here? Roughly what proportion of nuclear power workers around the country are unionized?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor, and there's nothing in this particular record that says a high percentage of Exelon's employees are unionized. But I think an important point here is that this appeals procedure that's in the regulations applies across the board. And as we read the appeal procedure, which now makes an internal review mandatory, whereas it used to be discretionary with the licensee, provides a floor of protection for all employees, including those who are not covered by collective bargaining agreements. So that what it's done is it's set a floor, but the district court viewed it as a ceiling and, in our view, turned the regulation upside down. And that's precisely the problem with its reading of this particular provision. The district court relied also on another provision, subsection A4, which states in part that only a licensee shall grant an individual unescorted access. This sentence appears in a paragraph that addresses the relationship between the licensee and contractors and vendors on whose access authorization programs the licensee relies. Now, this could be a vendor or a contractor that actually implements an access authorization program for the licensee, or it could also be a contractor like a construction contractor whose employees come into the plant for certain purposes and who need unescorted access. And in that case, the licensee would also rely on the contractor's program. But what this provision speaks to is that even though the licensee can rely on the contractor or vendor's program, the ultimate decision and the ultimate responsibility for making access decisions lies with the licensee.
Well, that was a pretty significant policy change, wasn't it, in the 2009 regs?
Not as we read it, Your Honor. If you look at the language starting in 1991 when these regulations were first promulgated and following through their proposal in 2006 and 2009, they all basically say the same thing, The language in 1991 in this provision, if you look at the provision as a whole, speaks to, it talks about the relationship between the contractors and vendors. And the sentence at issue in 1991 said, in any case, referring back to this relationship, the licensee is responsible for granting, denying, or revoking unescorted access authorization to any contractor, vendor, or other affected organization employee.
Maybe I'm not as sharp on this detail as perhaps I should be, but I thought that, in essence, you've got in the industry, you've got vendors who provide services at a number of expert services, for example, at a number of different power plants, and they've got their own security clearances and background check programs. And this allocation of responsibility has been a part of the industry really almost from day one, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so I thought one of the changes here was, in essence, some adjustment of that relationship and more emphasis on the licensee as bearing that ultimate responsibility.
Well, if you look at the NRC's commentary, again, starting in 91 and looking at 2006 and 2009, it doesn't really say that it's adjusting the relationship. What it says is it's clarifying it. And that it's making clear that even though contractors and vendors have their own programs, and to a certain extent the licensee can rely on them, when it comes to that relationship, ultimately it's the licensee who's responsible. And if you look at the commentary, they talk about things like, you know, particularly with contractors, construction contractors that travel from licensee, from plant to plant to plant, they were concerned with making sure that if access was granted at one facility in compliance with the NRC regs, they'd be able to carry that access authorization to another facility owned by another licensee. And the early comments on this provision say that they're trying to clarify that ultimately, in each case, it is the licensee's responsibility.
Why doesn't that principle inform the question at issue here?
Well, because,
which is, you know, to say that it specifies that the licensee has exclusive authority over this whole access issue.
Well, for a couple of reasons, Your Honor. First is that, again, you have to read this in context. But second of all, if you start, again, starting with the 1991 regulations, in 1991, in promulgating the initial regulations, there was this provision, which, as I said, we view as, in substance, virtually identical to the language or the provision that now exists. And the NRC talked about what this provision meant. At the same time, it had a provision, this other provision, that talked about the appeal procedure. And at that time, the internal review was discretionary. But what it said at that time about the appeal procedure was that they did not mean to preclude parties from utilizing collectively bargained dispute resolution mechanisms. So at the same time that the NRC was speaking to the authority of a licensee with respect to its program and with respect to its contractors and vendors, it also was saying that they didn't see any problem with utilizing a collectively bargained review procedure.
Right, but that aspect of the regulatory scheme has changed.
But it hasn't changed to preclude it, Your Honor. What the regulatory scheme says is a step in the appeal procedure, which was previously discretionary, that is that the appeal procedure may be internal independent review, now says the appeal procedure must provide for independent internal review. It doesn't say it must provide only an independent internal review, and it doesn't say that the independent internal review must be the final step in the appeal procedure. It simply takes what used to be discretionary on the part of the licensee and now makes it a mandatory aspect of its appeal procedure.
But it vests the authority to make the decision exclusively in the licensee. And that principle of exclusivity runs through the regulations.
But it did before, Your Honor, as well. I mean, I think my point here is that There's nothing in the overall scheme here that has really changed, except saying that this appeal procedure, which the NRC said in 1991 was an important part of assuring that employees felt that there was due process here in their review procedures, they've now strengthened the protections for employees. And we don't believe that that can be read to say that they intended to preclude arbitration. And I think it's important to note that there's absolutely nothing in the record here. Since 1991, the NRC has said nothing about arbitration or about collective bargaining agreements. And that silence, I think, is extremely important for three reasons. And I realize I'm going into my rebuttal time, but let me just quickly say that there are three reasons that the NRC's silence on this is important. First is that it's no secret that these cases were being arbitrated before 2006 or before 2009. We've listed some cases in our reply brief where licensees challenged arbitration decisions over access denial decisions. The NRC never intervened in any of those cases, nor is there any indication in the record, in the regulatory record, the administrative record of these regulations, that the NRC or anyone else for that matter, including Exelon and its trade association, NEI, was sufficiently concerned about this issue to make it an issue in the rulemaking proceeding. The second point is that if the NRC had intended to effectuate this kind of substantive change, the Administrative Procedure Act would have required it to make it an issue by publishing a notice, making clear that this was on the table, giving the public an opportunity to comment, and explaining the change in the language, and it did none of that. Now, Exelon has argued that precluding arbitration is a logical outgrowth of the NRC's statement that it was trying to increase the rigor of the regulations, and it's permitting an agency to make these kind of changes based on that kind of general statement would completely swallow the APA's notice requirements. And finally, just final point here is that it's highly unlikely that the NRC would have eliminated arbitration without saying so. There is, as we've explained in our briefs, a strong federal policy favoring the arbitration of labor disputes. There's a strong federal policy in the Federal Arbitration Act, which the Supreme Court reaffirmed last week in its decision in CompuCredit Corp. versus Greenwood, in which it said that if Congress is going to preclude arbitration, it must do so explicitly. And barring arbitration would run counter to, would intrude into an area protected by the NLRA. So because precluding arbitration, where the NRC previously said it was permitted, would run contrary to all of these policies, it should not be lightly inferred the NRC would have done so without having said anything.
This was the impetus for all these changes, the impetus for the issue here before was 9/11, right?
That's the impetus for increasing the rigor. Yes, I think it was 9/11.
So that takes it out of the sort of general labor relations issue you're talking about, doesn't it?
Well, Your Honor, I think the point here is that if the NRC felt or believed that permitting parties to arbitrate these access decisions somehow undermined the safety and security of nuclear plants, it probably could have exercised its authority and issued a regulation saying that it was going to change this rule. But without going through, the NRC is not released from the Administrative Procedure Act requirements. And having done nothing to put the parties on notice that this is what it was doing, nor even in announcing its final rule saying that that's what it has done, we do not believe that these regulations can be read to effectuate that change.
Ms. Bohr, a couple of quick questions before you sit down. First of all, is the NRC aware of this litigation?
We have to believe that it is, Your Honor, but it has not weighed in.
Okay. And also, the plaintiff Exelon raised a suggestion that they think under the new regs, arbitrators would have themselves to qualify for unescorted access under the regs as well, people don't have. Has that ever been done in the past?
Not that we're aware of, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the Court, Brian Gold on behalf of the Appellee Exelon Council. Your Honors, in considering this case, there really are three critical pieces of language. Counsel mentioned two of them, and I'll touch on the third as well. The first is 73.56A4, which now says in the regulations, but did not say before, only a licensee, the emphasis on the word only, a licensee shall grant an individual access. The other provision, which also was mentioned, is the 73.56L, which changed the language from may provide for an impartial and internal management review to must provide for an internal and impartial management review. And the third, which has not been touched on today but is discussed in the briefs, is the NEI 0301, which is the trade association for the nuclear industry, but the regulatory guidance that was issued in response to that NEI 301, which said that the NEI 301, which was quite clear in saying that this arbitration was not allowed.
Yes,
says,
the NEI statement itself is very clear on this.
The NEI statement is clear, correct, and I'll touch on, Judge Hamilton, your point, but they did say it meets the intent and substance of the rule. The other language, and you can look at other regulatory guidance from the NRC, is pretty stock language from the NRC with respect to all regulatory guidance. The meets the intent and substance of the rule, we submit, is not and was intended to be quite directly from the NRC, reflect its interpretation of the rulemaking.
That's the agency's language or preferred language of endorsement, is it?
Well, that is not, to my understanding, meets the intent and substance of the rule is more unique language. The stock language, I think, is what Judge Hamilton maybe have alluded to in terms of the discussion, the briefs that the union points out, where it says it's an acceptable method. I think you'll find
it also says that regulatory guides are not substitutes for regulation and compliance with them is not required. Let me ask you, Mr. Gold, if an employee had his access revoked and sued for race discrimination and won, could a court order a grant of unescorted access as part of a remedy?
We don't believe the court would have authority to grant. They certainly could grant reinstatement, but the access determination would still be governed by the NRC regulations.
Any authority to that effect, apart from your interpretation of this language?
I don't. To my understanding, I'm not aware that that precise issue has been litigated.
Has that position been adopted anywhere? Has the NRC taken that approach, for example?
I don't think it would be different, Judge Hamilton, than situations where there are other requirements, for example, for someone to be reinstated to the job. I've been involved in cases, for example, where apart from the nuclear industry, and I think maybe perhaps in fact in the nuclear industry, where they've raised it with the district court, for example, about conditions that would be required to reinstatement. And I've never encountered a situation where the judge didn't make those conditions a condition of the reinstatement ruling.
It might be something like a state license, for example. You can't reinstate an over-the-road trucker without a commercial driver's license, something like that. But here it would be a decision by the party before the court. The court couldn't order an employer to remedy that if it found that the revocation itself was a violation of Title VII.
I think the court could find under Title VII that the termination was a violation of Title VII. I don't think within the scope of Title VII is the revocation issue and the access issue is teed up. I think Title VII only covers whether the individual was terminated based on discrimination. Yeah. The court could order reinstatement, but Title VII does not provide the court with authority to have access as a part of that.
Has any court said that?
I'm not aware that that issue has been teed up one way or the other, Your Honor. One important context that I want to talk about is the context of the earlier Judge Lefkoe litigation, which has been referred to, I think, as Exelon 1 in the union submission. And the union points out in its reply brief, and I wanted to briefly address this, that the NRC couldn't have been addressing Judge Lefkoe's decision in its rulemaking because the decision had not yet been issued at the time of the when the NRC earlier posted the final draft of the rules, but not the issuance of the rules. In fact, that litigation before Judge Lefkoe, even though a decision had not been issued, was well underway at that time, having had initial briefs and response briefs. The import of that is not to say that the Judge Lefkoe decision provides the regulatory history, if you will, but it does, I think, crystallize the import of the several sections that I mentioned at the outset that have importance and what the party's view, not just the company's view, was at that time.
Mr. Gold, I gather that you all think that this issue of the arbitrability of access revocations is a pretty important public policy issue, right?
We think the NRC's statement with respect to access itself is an important public policy issue. That's correct, Your Honor.
And important to the NRC?
Important to the NRC, important for public safety as well.
And we know that as of 1991, the NRC was already on record as saying arbitration of these issues is okay with us.
In 1991, they were on record.
And through the last 20 years, has the NRC ever said, we've changed our mind about that?
Well, we think the rules...
You know the APA. You know how... You know how the industry and its lawyers would react if the NRC tried to do this kind of a stealth regulatory change without providing notice of a significant policy change, right? Suppose they tried to suddenly, because of a need for increased rigor, indirectly change some language to increase seismic requirements or security requirements. You guys would be all over them, right?
For
violating the APA?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor, but I can tell you that the change that took place in these regulations put every third party, whether it be a union, whether it be a contractor, whether it be a vendor, on notice.
Nobody mentioned it, right?
No, I think it was mentioned quite clearly.
Where?
In 73.5.
No. Somewhere in the notice and comment process.
Yeah. And with respect,
there's nothing from the NRC, is there, that signals an intent to change this 1991 stance on arbitration?
What there is, Your Honor, in the regulations and in the commentary of the regulations is to, in connection with increasing the rigor, a statement that the only the licensee, in very strong terms, discussing relative to everyone else, which would include, as a subcomponent of that, the arbitration process, doesn't have a final say.
Without
only the licensee
saying so.
Has a final say.
Okay. And then, was anything in the public comments? I mean, people have been litigating these arbitration issues for at least 20 years, right? Anything in the public comments from the industry or from unions saying, wait a minute, we think that this language is going to have this effect, and we think that's a bad idea?
Not that
or a good
of
idea?
Not that I'm aware of either way, Judge.
The industry didn't endorse this change in order to eliminate arbitration?
Not in terms of the commentary. It did not, Your Honor. Obviously, it does endorse the change and did so through the NEI, which,
right,
as I said, the NRC, I think, interprets to be correct. The point I was getting to with the interpretation of both parties with respect to the regulations and the import of the several sections in the Judge Lefkoe litigation was that... The central part of the union's argument in that case was that the NRC rule in effect, the 73.56L, may be an independent and impartial review. That was central to the union's argument in the Judge Lefkoe decision. As we know, that particular provision was changed to must by the NRC as that litigation was ongoing.
And why does that mean that's the only review allowed?
Well, we think it does in a couple ways. One is we think it needs to be read in conjunction with only a licensee can be the one who grants access, and only a licensee, therefore, can do it in terms of the...
Is that linkage established by the NRC anywhere in its commentaries or in the proposed rulemaking?
We think it is established through the NRC and its regulatory guidance.
Point me to the language. In the notice and comment process.
I wasn't addressing that, Your Honor.
Okay. It's not there.
The change that I think that evinces is that that was one of the two pillars of the union's argument before Judge Lefkoe, that May meant May, the NRC shortly thereafter changed it to must. The union argues context. We think that's a critical context for the court to consider. The other central component was the earlier NEI 0301, which expressly, the Industry Trade Association expressly stated in that the in independent arbitration review process was permissible, and the NRC, in similar stock language that I referred to earlier, but not the intent and substance language, essentially affirmed that interpretation by the industry. That was the other change that came later, namely in the later revision of the NEI. It went 180 degrees. It eliminated the reference to independent arbitral review in the NEI 0301, and it had an express thing that essentially said such independent review was prohibited. So from our perspective, it
sounds like what you want us to do is give Seminole Rock deference to the industry trade group.
No, I think we want you to give Seminole Rock deference to the NRC's statement in response to the NEI that was clearly different than the prior NEI and said it meets the intent and substance of the regulation. We don't know how, on the one hand, it can meet the intent and substance of the regulation, and at the same time, something that's diametrically opposite can meet the intent and substance of the regulation. It's nonsensical to reconcile.
It includes a lot of disclaimers about not having any binding effect, right? And then one other question I had that hasn't really been raised, this is a pretty significant policy change from your perspective. You've said it's important to the NRC, public policy. And what we've got here is actually nothing from the NRC itself. We have staff. Does staff guidance deserve Seminole Rock deference? In Seminole Rock itself, we had the price administrator during World War II making those decisions. Does that same degree of deference apply to this kind of staff document?
Well, I think that if you peruse, which I'm sure you have, the Seminole Rock law, there's lots of things that are far less than regulatory guidance issued by an agency after the vetting process that's described within the contours of how the NRC does vet its regulatory guidance that's given Seminole Rock deference. I think this rises to a much higher level than what you'll find in the case law.
With a 180-degree reversal on a significant public policy issue.
Well, I said the significant public policy issue, Your Honor, relates to the safety issue of the access authorization requirements. I think that the issue with respect to the arbitration falls under the umbrella of a broader interest by the NRC to make sure only the licensee makes these decisions because only the licensee is accountable to the NRC.
Mr. Gold, if this issue is so important to your client, why doesn't it simply bargain over this issue? You've entered into collective bargaining agreements for many years with broad grievance procedures. Why not put this into the management discretion portion of the collective bargaining agreement?
Your Honor, it's really not the issue in our judgment. The issue is that we are a licensee when we run nuclear power plants, first and foremost, and we're bound to comply with the NRC's license requirement. It's important to us to comply with those license requirements, and that fundamentally is why the client has taken the position that it has taken.
Without the NRC having told you have to do this. So.
Well, we disagree on that point, obviously, Your Honor. We think the NRC has told us that we have to do this, and the district court agreed with that.
There is a retroactivity issue here.
Would you like me to address that, Your Honor?
Yes.
The retroactivity issue, we've had a little bit of debate over that in the briefs in terms of the distinction between the remedy that an arbitrator can provide on the one hand and the actual decision to deny access or reinstate access, as the case may be, that the arbitrator can make. We're not quarreling here today that if the internal management review process determined that somebody was incorrectly denied access, and that ought to have their access reinstated, the union has the full panoply of remedies available to it under its contract in terms of back pay, and the like that it can raise separately under the collective bargaining agreement. The issue then is one of process, and that is the process of who gets to decide, the internal management review or separately an outside arbitrator. If you look at the Landgraf decision, which dealt with the 1991 Civil Rights Act amendments, I think it was clear that the Supreme Court, if only confronted with the issue of whether these cases ought to go to a jury or remain in the province of a judge, would have found that retroactivity was not...
That's very different than the arbitrability question. It's the difference between an outside review and an inside review. The difference between a judge and a jury, those are both independent arbiters. So it seems to me vested rights have been impacted here if this is applied retroactively.
Yeah, well, I guess what we would say is that, it doesn't change the conduct. One is not going to put themselves at jeopardy or put themselves at jeopardy, as the case may be, depending on who gets to decide their decision. The issue of remedy may touch more closely on what one's expectations may be going forward, but the issue of who gets to decide doesn't shape conduct. The Supreme Court found in Landgraf that the issue of a jury, and I would submit that all things being equal, as a defense lawyer, on the one hand, you would prefer a judge to decide and instead of a jury, and probably the opposite. So it does, the decision making does have the same kind of effect in that context as it would in the arbitral versus independent management review context. Yet the Supreme Court found that that wasn't the case. If I could,
Follow up on one,
yeah.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Quick point. In the years that these revocation of access decisions have been subject to arbitration, have arbitrators been required to comply with the access program themselves?
Since the regulations, Exelon has taken the position.
That's not my question.
But let me, I understand. There hasn't been a situation that has arisen where the arbitrators, where we've gotten to that. And what I mean by that, Your Honor.
We have lots of cases of arbitration over the last several decades, right?
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood. I thought you said since the new
regulations. No.
No. Prior to the new regulations, the answer is no.
Now, are any of did the new regulations change the provisions that you're saying require now that arbitrators themselves qualify for access?
What we're saying, Your Honor, is in order to make an access, yes, in the sense that we're saying that in order to make an access decision, you have to have certain qualifications, and that those regulations have changed in terms of who the decision makers are.
Any discussion of the in the notice and comment process?
Not specific to arbitrators, but specific to others involved in the process, there was.
Thank you.
Mr. Gold, your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I'd like to address the deference question that you raised, Your Honor. It's our view that the guidance document, if it gets any deference whatsoever, is not Seminole Rock deference, but Skidmore deference. And that is that, as this court described in Joseph versus Holder, guidance documents which are not developed through any kind of formal procedure, that are not intended to have the force of law, and in particular in this kind of situation, which are developed by the staff and not by the agency formally, are given Skidmore deference. And in this situation where the agency has given no reasoning, it's not consistent with other pronouncements, the deference level is pretty low. But I think it's also important to look at this document and say, well, what would you be deferring to? What it says, as you pointed out, is simply that this is an acceptable method for complying with the regulations. And it says other methods might also be acceptable. It doesn't speak to what those other methods might be. And from our perspective, most importantly, it doesn't say what would not be acceptable. That's the first point. The second point I wanted to make is that Mr. Gold said that the language of A4 that says that only the licensee can grant access is not actually that different from what was proposed in 2006. The language proposed in 2006 said, in any case, only a licensee shall grant or permit an individual to maintain unescorted access. Only a licensee. And in its commentary to that language, what the NRC said was the proposed paragraph would retain the intent of the current requirement that only licensees and applicants have the authority to grant or permit an individual to maintain unescorted access to protected and vital areas. And as I said earlier, that original intent was articulated by the NRC at the same time that it was also saying we see no problem with having a collectively bargained process for reviewing these determinations.
Board, thank you very much. Thanks to both parties. The case will be taken under advisement.